Hey, it's Molly Webster. I have a surprise for you. Next month, myself and producer Mona Medgaukar are going to do an AMA about our snail sex tape episode. You can ask us anything about snails and the behind the scenes of making an episode work. How long did it take us to make? How did we come up with the sound effects? Why are snails and slugs related? The AMA will be on April 16th, and in order to come, you have to be a member of the lab. So go to radiolab.org/join right now, sign up, use the code word snail to get a discount on your membership. And also, if you sign up now, you get a snail enamel pin. If you're already a member of the lab, come to the AMA. Thank you for listening. Can't wait to see you there, April 16th.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Latif. This is Radiolab. And today I have with me Asara.
Okay, no echo or anything?
Nope.
Okay, great.
As in Radiolab reporter producer Sara Kari.
Can you hear me without an echo?
Oh, yeah, no. You sound great.
And
Sarah's here in the studio.
I have a Sarah.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Nice to talk to you.
Sarah Zhang, who writes for The Atlantic and is a wildly prolific science journalist.
Oh, thank you.
Like, I feel like you cover COVID. I know you cover autoimmune diseases. I know you cover Ozempic.
I'm sort of lucky enough to cover just like whatever I'm interested in.
But we called her up because a while back, she noticed something weird happening to the deer in the Florida Keys.
I don't know if you know about the key deer. They're like really cute. They kind of like wait at bus stops and people like to feed them.
Okay.
And so back in 2016,
a very grave situation for this endangered key.
People suddenly started noticing with all these like ugly, like grisly wounds on these deer.
Gaping holes or wounds in their neck or in their head.
Literally, you could see down to the bone.
Gruesome, painful.
Ooh.
It's a very sad sight.
So it was, you know, it was kind of like a weird thing happening in Florida story.
Yeah.
But
volunteers are teaming up to treat affected animals.
What it turned out was that there was an infestation of an insect called
the New World Screwworm.
New World Screwworm.
The New World Screwworm. Also known as flesh-eating worm.
Oh.
And, like, I had never heard about screwworms before.
Yeah, me
yeah,
either.
No.
I would imagine most Americans have never heard about screwworms before. And the reason we don't know about it is because it's been eradicated from our country.
Huh.
I was like, what? Like, that's crazy. I've never heard of, like, an insect being, like, completely eradicated from our country.
And as Sarah started to dig into this,
it got even crazier and crazier.
What she found was the kind of amazing story of one of the biggest environmental interventions that humanity has ever undertaken. And the story of this worm, this honestly nightmarish flesh-eating parasite, that despite those efforts, is right now, today, back in the news.
We are on screwworm watch, and we are ready.
Forcing public health officials and ranchers and ethicists.
Here we are in the sixth major extinction that we humans are causing.
To ask maybe one of the biggest questions that we as beings on this planet can ask.
Would it ever be okay to bring about the extinction of a species?
Oh, boy.
Yeah. But, I mean, these are about the worst parasite on Earth. I cannot imagine anything worse than these guys.
So one of the first people we called when we got into this whole screwworm thing was the author Sam Keen.
My name is Sam Keen. I am a science writer.
Because it turns out he, like Sarah, at some point had fallen into the screwworm hole.
Yeah. I had never heard of them. And I started Googling, and then I went to Google Images, and I immediately regretted doing that.
And according to Sam, the reason that none of us had ever heard about what he called the worst imaginable parasite on Earth is because of something that in 1970, the New York Times called
the single most original thought of the 20th century.
And it turns out that thought was born in the brain of a man named
Edward Nippling.
Edward Nippling.
So, as you know, Latif, when we first learned about this, I got obsessed and started doing some digging.
Yeah.
And learned that Nippling has unfortunately passed away. But
Dr. Edward F. Nippling, we're happy to be here in your home today, and thank you for participating in this oral history.
I found this whole trove of interviews that he did back in the day.
If you could start, please, by telling us when and where you were born.
I was born in Port Lavaca, Texas, March 20th, 1909.
Nippling grew up on his family farm in Texas, and
in those days, farming was a very difficult occupation.
Honestly, mostly because of the, what was I supposed to say after that?
The screwworm.
Oh, mostly because of screwworms.
Yeah, so it was a problem for ranchers. Actually, I think this is a quote I remember. It was, screwworms used to strike fear in the hearts of ranchers all throughout the southern United States.
Could you just tell me what a screwworm even is?
It is a fly. It has kind of like...
Why do they call it a worm if it's a fly?
Well, flies are also maggots, right? Like, our flies come from maggots. So the maggot phase is a worm.
Okay.
So basically what they do is that if you have a little, like, nick in your skin, a little wound...
Even something as small as a tick bite?
These flies would lay their eggs in those wounds.
Roughly 400 eggs at a time.
Oh my God.
And then these maggots essentially would come out. They kind of look like a small white thread.
They have this kind of horrifying mouth with two sharp teeth and a little ridge on their body that sticks out exactly the way the threads on a screw do. They would twist themselves down.
Kind of burrow themselves into the flesh like a screw, and they would eat the flesh. Ugh. Yeah, it's...
And they are extremely hard to get out once they have locked in.
A screw worm would get into the... navel of calves when they were born. Or...
And so back to young Edward Nippling.
He got probably the worst job on the farm, which was to pick the screwworms out of the family's cows.
And that was a very unpleasant task.
Have to try to yank them out of these animals that obviously aren't happy about this.
Is there a tool you used? Like, what
I'm guessing a tweezers or just fingers.
Oh. Screwdriver. You got to use a screwdriver.
That was his job. And it introduced a lifelong hatred of screwworms in his heart, you know, understandably so.
But at the same time, you know, he has sort of a scientific bent of mind. He's curious.
He was actually kind of fascinated by insects.
Over time, he became a bug nerd.
Definitely a bug nerd.
Even named his cats after insects.
One after a mosquito and one after a boll weevil. Antonomus and Culex.
And when he grew up
to be an entomologist. But also, kind of in the back of his mind, he was always thinking, well, I have to figure out a way to control screwworm. I want to put a stop to them somehow.
And as it happens,
the first job I had...
In the late 30s, he got a job at the USDA.
As an entomologist working on the screwworm. That was the Bureau of Entomology and Plant Quarantine at that time.
And then World War II breaks out.
And the military enlists him in developing...
insecticides and repellents for use by the... for the armed purposes.
He actually ends up helping develop DDT.
Oh, yeah. Heard of that one.
And this is actually sort of part of his journey, which is that he saw insecticides can be really effective, but they can also be really devastating for the environment.
Mm.
So after the war, when he gets back to his screwworm job, he's just thinking about this problem.
Like, how can we figure out a way to control insects that does not require spraying lots of poisons?
And his way of trying to figure that out is watching screwworms mate.
Just watching a lot of insect sex.
As one does? Like, what? Well, yeah, why?
I think he was just trying to understand these pests, right? To think, like, what could we do about it?
Huh.
And so one day, a colleague of Nippling's is, you know, watching the screwworms have their sexy times, and he makes this observation.
That sounds like maybe not that important or not that interesting.
But that kind of hinted at something. He wasn't quite sure what exactly.
Which is that females only mate once.
Whether or not they get pregnant, they get one shot to have intercourse and try to have eggs.
I really feel for these females. Like, this is such a high stakes. You have to have the best sex of your life in that one time.
Yeah, that's it.
But Nippling, he's looking at this and he's like, wait.
If you could just do something to all of the males, right? Like, if you could just make the males sterile.
And then if he could trick the female screwworms into mating with these sterile males,
the females aren't going to lay any eggs. They're viable.
That would essentially take those females out of circulation for reproduction purposes.
Their one shot would just be doomed to fail, basically.
Yes, exactly.
So just like somehow flood the zone with sterile males is the idea.
These poor females already had it so hard, and now he's just like ruining the dating pool for them.
It's a little diabolical from the fly's perspective.
But lucky for these screwworm ladies.
It wasn't like that was a very practical idea.
Because how would you even pull that off?
You know, how do you mass sterilize a bunch of insects?
But then he finds a paper.
An article in a scientific magazine.
Basically, since World War II, there's sort of like a lot of interest in like, what can we do with radiation?
Oh, of course. Right. Yeah.
And this paper was by a geneticist who was saying that
it was possible to sterilize fruit flies by exposure to X-rays.
And I think he sort of jumped off of his couch and said, oh, my God.
Maybe we could sterilize screwworm.
Like, this could be the solution to the problem.
Okay, so what does he do?
Well, so the thing he needs is a bunch of X-ray machines.
But he decides he's not going to go public and try to get any funding for this.
We knew that if the media got a hold of that, they could make quite a deal out of this.
I mean, remember, he's working for the government. Like, taxpayer money is at stake here.
What happens if the press gets hold of this and then we're just totally ridiculed for, like,
wasting money or something.
Watching insect sex all the time.
Not in a weird way.
Yeah.
So we were rather cautious about that.
So he decides he wants to do this kind of on the down low.
And basically he gets one of his colleagues
to take a bunch of screwworms and sneak them into a nearby military hospital and use the X-ray machines there.
Flesh-eating worms in a hospital. Great.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, but how does he get the screwworms in?
Unfortunately, we don't have many details about what he did to actually get inside there. Mm-hmm. I pictured, you know, him like hanging out at the loading dock at night and like grabbing the door right before it shuts. Or, you know, like Watergate, like taping the lock or something like that, sneaking through the hall. I believe they did this at night, too. He had to be kind of clandestine about it, sneak around a little bit.
And they are literally like, you know, putting these flies through the X-ray machine and be like, hey, what happens?
But the problem with shooting a bunch of radiation at a bunch of flies
is that you create all these mutations, a bunch of random mutations. So you might just kill the fly. That's kind of a problem.
Right.
So they found that they figured out the right dose, but they also figured out exactly when to put them through radiation. It's when the fly's testes are developing, right? Because that's like what you really want to knock out. So that happens to be between 5.5 and 5.7 days.
So it's like they've got it to within hours.
Yes, yes.
And when they do that, bingo.
It seems to work.
But
of course, the next thing was, would they perform in a natural population?
It's not enough to just do it in a lab.
So then he decides it's time for a real-world test, and he found an island off Florida.
On the island of Sanibel.
Sanibel Island.
He shows up there with some of the radiated screwworms from his lab, releases them on the island.
And it did not work.
Like, the population of screwworms stayed pretty much the same.
The experiment failed. And Nippling was glad he hadn't said anything or, you know, gone after public money.
So, yeah, does he just resign to his failure?
That's the end of the story, yeah.
No, not the end of the story.
We were kind of stymied what to do for a year or so, and then I got a letter from a veterinarian on the island of Curaçao.
A Dutch island called Curaçao.
Where is Curaçao?
Off the coast of Venezuela.
He wrote a letter.
And said, the goats here are being ravaged. I know you study this. Can you help us in any possible way?
And I thought, well, this is just the place that we're looking for.
And this time, Nippling wants to go all out.
They were not going to take a chance that there would be too few flies.
Like, no more handful of flies from his rinky-dink lab.
They're going to set up an industrial facility for making these flies.
And, like, carpet Curaçao.
And really overwhelm them with the sterile males to make sure that they were doing everything they could to give this experiment a chance of success.
Mm.
So in this factory that they set up,
they came up with a formula for the food that they were going to feed them.
Okay.
And it was ground horse meat
that they soaked in blood and they would let that get putrid.
Wow.
And then they would douse it with formaldehyde.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And it was cheap enough to get, you know, so they knew they could produce a lot of this stuff pretty quickly.
Okay.
Why the formaldehyde? I don't know why. That's such a weird...
Apparently, they just like the formaldehyde. I don't know.
It's just a little extra kick. It's like hot sauce for them.
So then from about March 1954, they are producing 170,000 of these sterile adults per week.
They are feeding them this slurry, though, at this point, without the formaldehyde.
It took 40 tons of the slurry to get that job done.
Wow.
And it was a smashing success. The population plummeted after they started releasing these flies. His big idea had worked.
Back in the United States,
when the livestock people, especially
ranchers, catch hold of this.
They came to us.
And they're like, wait, we really want this.
Eventually, the clamor from ranchers got so big, Nippling decided, well, I think the time is ripe
to try rolling out his screwworm strategy in the U.S. And so, armed with some funding from the USDA,
this new technique for insect control is eliminating screwworm.
The first big push started in about 1957.
In Florida.
And after about 2 years of dedicated work, they had eliminated them.
Not just in Florida, but everywhere.
East of the Mississippi.
That is huge.
And then it kind of keeps going west.
The Texas Cattlemen's Association hears about it.
I mean, it was a Texas-sized problem that they had.
They want in too, so Nippling and his team
end up building a really big factory in Texas.
Screwworm Eradication Headquarters at Mission, Texas. Here, millions of screwworm flies are being reared each day.
And all these, like, metal machines.
Sarah told us about a similar factory she went to in her reporting.
Many different rooms, sort of, like, all at different temperatures, different humidities for each phase of the life cycle.
I could not have imagined it smelled good.
I'm sorry to say this, but what it reminded me of was the smell of a used tampon.
Okay, it makes sense.
Blood that's gone a little bit bad, maybe.
From these factories, they start releasing flies multiple times a week.
So how do they do that?
By airplane.
These planes are being loaded with sterile male screwworm flies in Mission, Texas.
Basically, they would fly these little, like, prop planes and release these flies in the air.
They took them up in refrigerated boxes. They had to buy, essentially, cases of perfume and cologne and dump them on the boxes before the pilots would allow them in the airplanes. And then they would essentially open the hatch and just dump them out and let them fall down.
Oh, wow.
And at this point,
the Nippling strategy is working so well, screwworms are disappearing from all of the Southwest.
They started marching their way down to the border, pushing it down, pushing it down.
Eventually, people were like, well, screwworms obviously don't respect national borders.
If we're really going to deal with the screwworm problem, we would have to enlarge the program.
What if we just kept going?
This operation can now expand into Mexico.
You know, get them out of Mexico. Then we go down country by country through Central America.
That is so much ground to cover.
Yep.
And so all through the 70s, 80s, 90s,
there are all these kind of international agreements.
Frankly, this was a tough sell in some places because the U.S. has a history of meddling Central America.
Right.
Especially in this time.
But despite that, and despite political turmoil,
revolutions and coups and things like that.
Holy.
The disgust over screwworms was enough
that all seven countries in Central America came to the table.
And they started marching down, you know, a dozen miles at a time or so, just working down year by year, all the way down to the border between Panama and Colombia.
And in 2006, all of North America is declared screwworm free.
Wow.
And that so-called single most original thought in the 20th century changes the face of the entire continent.
Amazing.
And to this day, you know, at the time I was reporting it, like, there's still a factory in Panama. It's still producing millions of screwworms, growing millions of screwworms every day, flying a plane, I think that was three times a week, and maintaining this, like, basically this, what they called of it, like a sterile insect barrier.
The idea is that that area where Panama meets Colombia,
the Darien Gap, which I think it's been used a lot for other reasons.
That's like the most dangerous area for migrants, right?
Exactly.
But it's also one of the narrowest parts of the Americas, only about 60 miles wide.
Okay, so it's like a natural choke point.
Right. And because of that, maintaining that sterile screwworm barrier only costs
$15 million per year, which is a pretty reasonable price compared to the huge cost if screwworms were just kind of running wild.
Yeah, so when I was praying on this back in 2020, the money saved was estimated to be over $1 billion a year. So $1 billion saved compared to $15 million cost.
Wow, so that's a pretty good return.
And you know, obviously it was more expensive when you were, you know, in the active eradication phase.
Right.
But the maintenance cost, you know, is really not that much money for a government program. And it's just a, kind of an example of like how when with basic science, you don't always know exactly where it will go. But in this case, it ended up like creating this continent-wide, multinational collaboration that has been going on for decades and decades. And the fact that this all kind of started with someone like watching screwworms mate in the lab and having an epiphany is kind of remarkable.
Now, there have been a couple of small outbreaks here and there over the years, including the Florida one, the key
the deer
2016 one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they've all gotten tamped down pretty easily. Like, it didn't take all that much to beat those back. But when we come back from break, all kinds of things are going to break loose. News, biological barriers, and maybe also Latif's heart.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Guys, it's tax season. Are you as stoked as I am? No, no, of course you aren't. Because taxes can be super stressful. I know that I'm going to owe money, and so I'm avoiding all the emails from my accountant. I'm not alone. 88% of Americans reported financial stress at the start of 2026. So it's normal, but it doesn't mean you have to white-knuckle your way through. When life feels overwhelming, therapy can help. BetterHelp makes it easy, it says, by matching you with one of their over 30,000 licensed professionals tailored to your needs. And if it's not a perfect fit, you can switch at any time. And look, a therapist can't fix your money problems, but they can help you address shame, guilt, avoidance. Get matched with a qualified professional on BetterHelp. You can sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/radiolab. That's betterhelp.com/radiolab.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.
This is Radiolab. I'm Latif Nasser, here with producer Sarah Khari.
Hello.
And we've been talking to journalist Sarah Zhang and writer Sam Keen about screwworms.
Right. The skin-crawly, flesh-eating parasite that we all forgot about because nippling and his sterile flies drove it down south.
All the way to a biological demilitarized zone at the very bottom of North America, aka the southern border of Panama.
Yeah.
But in 2023, Panama suddenly started seeing
a massive spike in screwworm cases from like 25 cases a year to like thousands.
And since then,
it's only gotten worse.
The parasitic fly is moving north.
They have been steadily marching north.
Of this deadly insect.
They've been found in Costa Rica,
Nicaragua,
Honduras,
El Salvador, Guatemala.
They're even in Mexico.
Only 700 miles from the U.S. border.
And it turns out it's basically getting closer every day.
Less than 400 miles.
300 miles from Texas on the southern border.
It's gotten as close as
70 miles or so from the U.S. border.
Whoa.
This is an ongoing breaking news story.
So what happened? Like, how did they get past the biological wall?
There are a couple of theories.
One theory is that maybe the strain of screwworm that they were growing at the factory was not as effective anymore. Hmm. I don't know, maybe the ladies out there caught on to what was going on and weren't mating with them or something.
Yeah.
Just general disruptions due to COVID might have weakened the production a little bit.
Or maybe, Sam says, given that we live in a more and more interconnected world,
because it does still exist in South America,
where people and products and animals are moving from place to place, it was just a matter of time before these worms found their way through.
The best guess is that people were smuggling cattle that were infected,
yeah,
and then it just got out.
But regardless, as of today, right now, the screwworm,
it's sort of like knocking on our doorstep.
It's not a matter of if the deadly pest gets to the U.S., but when.
And surprisingly enough, in this time of cuts to science funding and all that, and, you know, the idea of building political will around something that everyone has pretty much forgotten seems dubious.
The issue has also alarmed Washington.
It actually does seem like the U.S. government is paying attention.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has snapped into action.
And really, just like Nippling's time, pretty much because of the cattle industry.
Billions of dollars of losses a year.
Of course.
It could truly crush the cattle industry as well as other livestock industry in Texas.
So, the USDA has started to set up screwworm traps along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Shut down the southern border.
They have agents on horseback.
Those so-called tick riders.
Patrolling the border for stray cows. Huh. They are pouring money into screwworm research. And, of course, they are rebuilding Nippling's fly factories.
They are now building a new facility down in Texas.
Another one in Mexico. All told, probably in the next couple years, we will be producing and releasing something like 500 million flies per week.
Wow.
And we probably will have spent like hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars.
Do you see this as like the modern cow factory farm system is like unsustainable and like this is just like one other band-aid to keep that system financially profitable or something? Like I could see an argument that's like, oh, this is just to help like big rancher businesses.
Yeah. Well, I think in a literal sense, like this program was created to help ranchers. Like that is, in fact, the express purpose of the USDA. So I think I wouldn't even argue with that premise. But this does affect wild animals too.
Right.
In Central America, like you used to see like howler monkeys fall out of trees because they had become so disfigured and sick from getting infested by screwworms.
And beyond that, I mean, actually, you know, this time around with this effort, it's not just the USDA that's involved in this program.
So I'll try and make the case on the human side of things. Number one.
So I talked to this public health official named Megan Nichols, who is at the CDC.
And my current role is incident manager for our New World Screwworm response.
Because the CDC is worried about this outbreak too. And the thing that Megan pointed out is that
these flies like to infest a wound.
I mean, you know, wildlife or cows aside, screwworms will happily lay their eggs in pretty much any warm-blooded animal, including humans.
And it can be a pretty small wound, like as small as a little cut or a bite on the skin.
I read that they can also get in through just like bodily openings. Is that true?
It is true. They are often attracted to mucous membranes, so eyes, nose, ears, urogenital.
Oh,
yikes.
So yes. And during this outbreak, there have been over 1,000 human cases, and the number continues to grow daily.
And to be fair, you know, like not to fearmonger here, this is not a pandemic-level human health crisis. Most people that take precautions will be totally fine.
But I also think very much about this on an individual level.
And the kinds of individuals that would be the most susceptible to a serious screwworm infestation, like folks who can't get medical help right away, or people who are unhoused, or have weakened immune systems, or even like kids with a lot of scrapes.
They're the last ones that need to deal with something like this.
And on the off chance that it does happen, it is kind of a horror show.
One of the most impactful images that I have seen related to 2025 was patients that were lining the hallway of a medical treatment facility in a country that is currently part of this outbreak. And the patient was holding a bowl in which they were basically sneezing out and pushing out larvae from their nasal passage. And other people who were lining this hallway basically waiting to be seen because they were also needing to get the maggots out of their body.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, all right. I now see the point that this is more than just the cattle industry.
Yeah.
But I do now wonder if it's just going to keep coming back. Like, is this just an inevitable cycle that we're now stuck in? Like, we're just going to have to keep doing this.
Yeah, you kind of are on a treadmill.
You're on a treadmill.
Using Nippling's technique, yeah.
Yeah. But I did, as I was reporting on this, come across a different way that people are starting to think about screwworm control.
So another option that is controversial, but scientists have been talking about it.
This is something that Sam mentioned, too.
Is something called a gene drive.
Okay, so what is that?
It kind of goes around the normal Mendelian laws of genetics.
Okay, so first of all, let's assume that you are a scientist that has modern day genetic technologies available to you, and you introduce a killing gene into the screwworm population.
You could make it lethal to be a female. So it could trigger something where females just don't get out of the egg stage.
It's like a little time bomb in the cell.
Yeah, exactly. And typically, if you were to try to do that, genetics would work its normal way, and that killing gene would only get inherited 50% of the time. And in every successive generation, it would become less and less common, and you'd have to keep reseeding that gene into the population.
Okay.
But this is where gene drives have a little extra trick.
In a gene drive, there's closer to 100% chance that the gene will get passed down.
Hmm. You can basically ensure that it'll get passed down every time.
Hmm.
And so it's kind of like a set it and forget it kind of thing. Like you introduce the killing gene and then you just let it have its way with the screwworm population.
The screwworms are going to be out there reproducing and spreading that gene by themselves very quickly.
And what that really means is eventually
it's going to wipe them out.
Not just, you know, beating screwworms back down to Panama, but like truly and wholly eradicating screwworms. Extincting them off the face of the planet forever.
I don't want us to have to live with these, but I don't want us to kill them forever. That feels wrong. That feels like we're doing something untakebackable that is not, that we should not be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean,
let me bring in one more person here.
So I'm Greg Capenick. I am a research scholar at the Hastings Center.
Because I think he feels a lot of the same way.
I mean, here we are in the early stages of the sixth major extinction, one that we humans are causing. And I mean, in a way, this seems like, gosh, joining forces with the other side in some way.
Mm. Yes, yes, exactly.
Well, but at the same time, Gregory has seen this potential use of gene drives coming on the horizon and really wanted to think about it more. So what he decided to do is get together a panel.
I thought, I'll turn to some environmental ethicists,
ecologists,
conservation biologists,
geneticists, entomologists,
some people with a public health background.
No one from the Texas Cattle Ranchers Association.
We already know what they think.
I thought it would be particularly interesting to bring together people who would be, by and large, kind of predisposed to want not to take out species.
So,
We gathered at Arizona State
in May 2024
for a day and a half of presentations and discussion.
They considered a couple of the top nasty species.
Like the mosquito species that is the main vector of malaria.
And one of them was screwworms.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the idea was to hash out some of the pros and cons for either side.
You know, keep, eliminate, and sort of report out our findings.
And given the group of people that were sitting at the table, they started out with some of the arguments that you might expect.
We need to think about the value of species.
What do you mean when you say that?
Yeah. I mean, there'd be different ways in which a species could be valuable.
Like, first off, there's some very practical ecological considerations.
I mean, the main question is, what's it doing in the wild? You know, is it a pollinator? Turns out screwworm is something of a pollinator, but
it, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, my gosh. Hmm.
Yeah. But it's probably not a very important pollinator.
Okay.
There are a lot.
Bees do it better.
The bees probably win.
Then you have to consider whether some other animal needs to eat it.
Probably, sometimes.
But turns out it's not really a key food source for any other animal.
Is it? Does it play an important role as a predator in keeping other species in check?
I mean, obviously, in this case, yes, it is a predator. But according to Gregory, the animals it eats
are already under pressure from human forces. So if anything, you want to ease the burden as much as you can on those species.
Mm.
Okay, but they did also consider some more abstract values that a species might have.
You know, aesthetic.
Aesthetic, interesting.
Educational, historical, scientific. I think that's the list.
Maybe we put it in terms of screwworm.
Yeah. In my mind, I was thinking about it like if you were going around the way you did and you opened it up to all your colleagues and then sitting there was a giant screwworm who was going to make the case to save itself. Yeah, like what's the best case that screwworm would make?
That's the hard case.
Aesthetic, clearly, yeah, obvious.
Yeah, right. Educational, like don't mess with nature, kids.
You know, jokes aside, though.
I mean, the main question.
Gregory says, you know, people like him do actually put a lot of stock in the sort of intrinsic value of a species.
It's this ingenious development in and of its own right.
You know, anything that's around today has been honed by millennia of evolution. And in that way, every species is
a marker of the creative natural forces that sustain life, that brought us into being. I mean, I feel like you have to try to put it in a practically poetic way in order to really convey what people are thinking.
So Gregory's group, after about a day and a half of discussing all of this,
we're all kind of exhausted and we're trying to put it all together.
And Gregory says, okay, we're going to go around the room one by one.
Sort of put everyone on the spot and see what they thought. And we did so. And by the time we'd gone around, most people had actually said, yeah, screwworm looks like a pretty good candidate.
Really? Like that it would be okay to wipe this species off the planet forever?
Yeah.
How did that feel? Is that awkward?
Well, I mean, it was this like, it was kind of like this serious moment. There was everyone was sort of sighing, uh-huh, or sort of like, oh, I really don't want to vote for this, but it looks like maybe the case can sometimes be strong enough.
But isn't there sort of like, I mean, this just feels like, you know, an idea that always comes up with ecosystems. Like we think we know and then we don't. Like there's always the knock-on effects that we never see coming and we thought we knew everything, but then it surprises us, but there it is. Like does it not feel like hubris to assume that we know everything that could potentially go wrong?
Yeah, but we did, in fact, at least up until very recently, get rid of screwworm in southern North America and throughout Central America. And, you know, the sky didn't fall. Mm. Other species didn't wink out because they weren't able to eat New World screwworm anymore. So we have a little bit of a kind of preliminary...
It's like experimental data.
Yeah, kind of. Like that suggests that it's probably not really that important ecologically.
So losing it, you know, doesn't seem to do any harm. And then on the other side,
part of what was so persuasive about it was that the death that it causes is exquisitely awful.
I mean, with screwworms, did you guys consider alternatives to eradication?
Like if there were some other kind of treatment for it, some sort of medicine that you could take.
Gregory says if it was possible to like separate screwworms from the thing that they do or like the disease that they cause of, you know, flesh being eaten, and if you could attack that disease, then great, you know? Like that's sort of the case with malaria and mosquitoes, where you can attack the disease or in that case the parasite rather than the mosquito. Mm. But with screwworms, there's just no way to do that. Like, eating flesh is in their nature. It's what they do. There's just no way to make them like vegetarians or make them uninterested in flesh.
The only way you get rid of the disease is by getting rid of the fly. At least at the time that we were meeting and writing, there was nothing else to do except pick it out if you can. Eliminate the flies.
Ugh, I don't know. I want to agree with him, but I don't know if that wins the day for me. Like, I don't disagree, but I just can't bring myself to agree.
No, this is, this is the part of the story where I feel like I agree with you. I don't know. I don't know what to do with the fact that I don't want screwworms to exist. You know, like, I think about, like, the people in South America. We just stopped at Panama. Yeah. Like, yeah. I don't know. I don't want them to have to deal with screwworms and suffer. But at the same time, this stuff gets scary. I guess
does.
One thing I will say, though, that Gregory did mention is that if we go down this path, theoretically, there is sort of an undo button here.
You can definitely keep it somewhere else in a facility or, you know, frozen eggs or something. And if it were to turn out that...
the cure for cancer was in the screwworm eggs or...
Really vital to the life cycle of this frog species in South America or something like that.
Some ecological Rube Goldberg machine got set off because we got rid of all the screwworms.
Yeah.
It would be possible to achieve something like de-extinction with screwworm.
To bring it back, to seed it, fling it out of the plains the way we're flinging out the sterile ones.
Yeah. And what we know from the outbreak in Central America now is that they can take off pretty well.
Imagine the public campaign where it would be like, hey, everybody, remember how
they used to exist.
Right. There's this one frog in Panama that this was really helpful for. So we're just going to drop these flesh-eating worms. We're just going to rain them down over you and your home.
Yeah.
So one last thing before we go. Back in 2016, Edward Nippling and his screwworm research won a Golden Goose Award. If you haven't heard of it before, the Golden Goose Award goes to U.S. government-funded science that sounds ridiculous but ends up changing the world. And Nippling's research was exactly that. Even years after it proved useful, members of Congress still ridiculed and scapegoated it.
Frivolous pork projects such as the screwworm research, $35 million.
As an example of government waste.
Even though the screwworm has been eradicated in the United States.
This is now the fourth Golden Goose-inspired story that we have done.
Nice.
We did one about cone snails called Golden Goose, one about a bacterium called the Age of Aquaticus, and one recently about honeybees called Time is Honey. And now this one, it's almost become like a sneaky little recurring series that if you ever meet someone who doesn't believe that the government should fund basic science, just play them one of these. We'll link them all in the episode description.
This episode was reported and produced by me, Sara Khari, with reporting help from Latif Nasser. Our fact-checker was Emily Krieger. Check out Sam Keen's podcast, The Disappearing Spoon. His episode about screwworms is linked in our episode description. Same goes for Sarah Zhang's latest story in The Atlantic. And if you are interested in hearing more about gene drives, check out our episode about it, the last 10 minutes of our CRISPR update.
Thank you to James P. Collins, Max Scott, Amy Murillo, Daniel Griffin, Phil Kaufman, Katie Barnhill, Arthur Kaplan, Ron Sandler, Yasha Rower, and our gaggle of friends at AAAS who administer the Golden Goose Award, Aaron Heath, Gwendolyn Bogard, Valeria Sabate, Meredith Asbury, and Joanne Padrone-Carney.
And the last thing, if you want more information on screwworm-infested areas or how you can take precautions to be safe, there is a website you can check out. It is screwworm.gov.
That's screwworm.gov. Sara, I guess it's time for us to just screw off.
Indeed.
And we'll catch you next week.
All right.
Hi, I'm Gabby. I'm from San Francisco, and here are the staff credits. Radiolab is hosted by Lulu Miller and Latif Nasser. Soren Wheeler is our executive editor. Sarah Sandbach is our executive director. Our managing editor is Pat Walters. Dylan Keefe is our director of sound design. Our staff includes Jeremy Bloom, W. Harry Fortuna, David Gable, Maria Paz Gutierrez, Sindhu Ninasambandan, Matt Keelty, Mona McGawker, Annie McEwen, Alex Neeson, Sarah Kari, Rebecca Rand, Anissa Vitsa, Arian Wack, Molly Webster, and Jessica Young, with help from Gabby Santis. Our fact-checkers are Diane Kelly, Emily Krieger, Natalie Middleton, Angeli Mercado, and Sophie Semayi. Leadership support for Radiolab's science programming is provided by the Simons Foundation and the John Templeton Foundation. Foundational support for Radiolab was provided by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.